Ayahuasca is a psychedelic brew that is traditionally used by indigenous cultures in the Amazon basin. The brew is made with the Banisteriopsis caapi vine and Psychotria viridis. And other ingredients may or may not be added, including the very dangerous and deadly Datura. The brew also contains MAOIs, or monoamine oxidase inhibitors, and DMT, or dimethyltryptamine, the most powerful psychedelic drug on Earth, which is also a natural neurotransmitter in all mammalian brains. If the ayahuasca experience were charted by a leading psychologist, what would the scientific research on its effects show? How do psychological studies on ayahuasca differ from anthropological studies? What happens when the full-blown psychedelic experience with ayahuasca is brought toe-to-toe with science? Can it be proved that the ayahuasca experience is real? Or is it only a culturally induced hallucination? Is the ayahuasca experience merely a single-type experience, or does it progress through many levels as the partaker works on him or herself? What if the experience of this mystical substance could be described in great literary detail that exceeds that of Aldous Huxley's Doors of Perception? Today I interview Professor Benny Shannon, Professor of Psychology at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Israel. Benny Shannon holds the Mandel Chair in Cognitive Psychology and Education. Born in Tel Aviv, Shannon studied in psychology and linguistics at Tel Aviv University and received his doctorate in experimental psychology from Stanford University. He is the author of the 2002 book, Antipodes of the Mind, Charting the Phenomenology of the Ayahuasca Experience, published by Oxford University Press. Benny Shannon is known for his controversial theory that the patriarch Moses was under the influence of hallucinogens when he received the law. Specifically, he believes that a psychedelic cocktail similar to ayahuasca may explain Moses' visions of the burning bush. Quote, in advanced forms of ayahuasca inebriation, the seeing of light is accompanied by profound religious and spiritual feelings. Upcoming shows, I have a couple of options for next week. One could be on 5-MeO-DMT, which is most likely, and also regarding new approaches to cognitive liberty. Also, the other could be with Eddie Lepp, one of California's largest medical marijuana growers, whose medical marijuana farm was raided in 2004 by federal agents. And Eddie has beat many of the charges against him, but last week a judge handed down a sentence of 10 years. And Eddie is to report on July 6th for prison should his appeal fail. And I consider Eddie a dear friend. He was a primary financial backer for getting my first book that I co-authored with Andrew Rutaji, my book Astrotheology and Shamanism. He helped get that in print. And I've also stayed up at his place many times. I met up with Eddie Lepp and Jack Hare yesterday in Los Angeles for the fundraiser for Eddie's defense fund. And for what he's been through, he's in amazingly good spirits. So free Eddie Lepp. I also mentioned last week that I have a few other people lined up for possible interviews, including Acharya S. and Steve Hager from High Times Magazine. Acharya has been on the show before regarding her last book, Christ in Egypt, and she's also got a new ebook out, and we thought we'd discuss that as well as some things that people bring up regarding her research and things like that. So that should be a very interesting conversation. I'm also working on getting Steven Zerlinga on the show as a follow-up to my interview with G. Edward Griffin last week on economics and the monetary system. And I must say the rabbit hole goes yet much deeper, as one person who contacted me regarding the interview pointed out. And so we still have much more to explore. And this show is now getting over 50,000 monthly listens and downloads, and we're maxed out on bandwidth, and we're also just about maxed out on storage space, and soon I will have to start pulling the older episodes from the gnosticmedia.podomatic.com website just to keep up with the cost of running the show. So I'll probably need to make a subscription area on the website that is only accessible through those of you who donate monthly. I also think that the forum will probably become subscriber-based as well. So anyway, I haven't begun to implement this yet, but it's something that we'll need to get done just to help keep up with things. And the shows that are removed from the Podomatic site will remain available for those subscribers. And things have really slowed down lately. We haven't had much in the way of donations. So again, I ask for your support for this show and this programming. I'm going to break the code of silence about not mentioning names and send a warm thank you to Dr. Craig, who made a much-needed donation to the show this week. Thank you, Craig. And please don't wait for somebody else to donate. It's your support we need, whether it's $2 or $50 or whatever you can afford to donate. And as always, we greatly appreciate your support. And if you consider this type of work important, as I've said before that I do, then please go to GnosticMedia.com and click on the donations button at the top left of the page. And I had a few more responses this last week regarding help with the transcriptions, but we still need more volunteers for that. So maybe if you're someone who's interested in helping out with the show, but maybe you can't afford to donate, this is a fantastic way to help. So please contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. And you can also help support the show by ordering a copy of the DVD or one of the books or the She Who Remembers audio archives from the gnosticmedia.com website. And as far as my book, Astrotheology and Shamanism with Andrew, I have 44 copies of the color, numbered, and signed edition remaining, which that one comes with a free Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD. And you can get yourself a copy of that in color or black and white. I also have copies of The Holy Mushroom, Evidence of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity available. These do go out autographed in appreciation for your support. And this week I've also put The Holy Mushroom copy number 4, numbered and autographed, up on eBay for auction to help catch up on some bills. This copy was originally saved for someone who ended up with 2 copies and didn't need this one. So if you're interested in bidding on this item to help support Gnostic Media and the show, please go to eBay.com and search The Holy Mushroom, and bidding on that starts at $49.99. And by the way, amazingly, this week I went on Amazon and some of the book resellers are already asking $303 to now $999 for a first edition of my first book, Astrotheology and Shamanism with Andrew. So if you got a copy of that, hang on to it. And if you didn't get a copy of that, don't let this opportunity for a possible collector get away. And hopefully this one will climb in value as that one seems to be. And also coming up, due to a death in my wife's family, we'll be traveling down to Peru in the next couple of weeks to visit with family members. And right now it appears that we'll be returning the week before the ayahuasca convention in Iquitos, Peru. So I'm going to ask you listeners out there for a little bit of a miracle. Since I'll be down there, I figured this would be a great opportunity to possibly get some additional interviews and some great material for the show. So if you are someone who can help us out with this, if you can donate or contribute in some way to get us there, help us stay there for an extra week or two, and to get to Iquitos, we'd love to hear from you. And finally, the views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself or Gnostic Media. If you would like to contact me, you can go to www.gnosticmedia.com or send an email to contact@gnosticmedia.com. And here is my interview with Professor Benny Shannon. Well, Benny, welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 34. How are you this morning?
Fine, thank you.
I'm really excited to have you on the show, and we might as well just dive right into the interview. I wanted to start off by asking you, who is Benny Shannon?
I should say that my last name is Shannon. It's a Hebrew name with one N and not an Irish name with two N's.
Oh.
Many people make this, this mistake. So it's Shannon. I'm a professor at the Department of Psychology at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. For the past 10 years, my main areas of research are, on the one hand, the phenomenology of human consciousness, and on the other hand, the philosophy of psychology. Earlier, my early academic training was in three disciplines: cognitive psychology, philosophy, and also linguistics. And for many years, I worked in linguistics, the psychology of language, and the philosophy of language. But with the years, I got more and more involved with, as I said, consciousness, and that's what I'm doing now.
Well, let me ask you, what is your educational background?
I've just said I had my undergraduate training in Israel, in Tel Aviv, in linguistics and philosophy. I have master's degrees in both philosophy and linguistics, and then I went to the United States and I completed my doctoral in cognitive psychology at Stanford.
Well, it's quite a background, and you know, your work is quite fascinating. So I've got to say that I've been very interested in your work, especially for the last couple of years. But you know, your work is very popular in the United States. Can you say something about your publications, especially the books you've written?
Yeah. I've published two books, and now I am working on a third one. The first one is called The Representational and the Presentational, and it's a comprehensive critique of what was, it was published in 1993, and it presents a comprehensive critique of the dominant view in the cognitive sciences today. This view, to which I object, is to regard human cognition as some kind of sophisticated computer programs, and characterizing human knowledge in terms, like with a computer, in terms of underlying symbolic representations, and looking at human behavior as resulting from the applications of computer-like computational operations upon these symbolic structures. And as I have noted, I feel that this view or this meta view is not adequate, both because of conceptual reasons and because of very technical reasons. I've looked at human cognition with its various domains: language, memory, thinking, perception, creativity, and in each one of them, I showed that this computational view of mine, even though on the surface it looks kind of very simple and straightforward, in effect, when one examines the details, one comes to the conclusion that it cannot work. So, as I said, the book came out in 1993 when this paradigm was the dominant one in the field. Since then, there have been a number of other criticisms of it. And last year, a new and expansion edition of it has come out. So that's the first book. The second is called The Antipodes of the Mind. It came out with Oxford University Press in 1903, excuse me, in 2003, and it deals with a special non-ordinary state of mind which is induced by ayahuasca, which is a powerful plant-made psychoactive potion that has been used in the Amazon area for millennia, and I've discovered it almost 20 years by chance, and gradually got to study it scientifically. The book I'm working on now is devoted to a new theoretical framework for the studying of human consciousness, and the idea is to have what I refer to as a unified theoretical framework, namely one that will encompass both ordinary and non-ordinary states of mind and analyze them within the same set of basic concepts.
This, you were talking a minute ago about the human brain. You not agreeing with the idea that the human brain runs like a program or with these symbols. Are you referring to Jungian philosophy?
No, I'm not sure what you are talking about.
I just meant a few minutes ago you were discussing how you don't feel that the brain operates like a computer, which has been the more traditional type. And the archetypes. what I'm getting at is is this method sort of a different way of looking at Jungian philosophy, or saying that is not the proper way to look at things, or am I mistaken here?
No, it's neither yes or no. No, I think your question is directed at a different direction altogether. Maybe it comes from clinical psychology. I'm an academic cognitive psychologist, not an applied or clinical one, and my goal is to find to understand how the mind works with respect to the basic higher mental functions, language, thinking, memory, creativity, as well as consciousness that I've noted just a moment ago. And my main view and my main orientation is phenomenological, that looks at the the surface constituted by experience and behavior. And when I'm saying surface, I'm contrasting it to the deep, deep either being the brain or deep. Well, the brain, of course, exists, but I'm a psychologist and not a brain scientist. So studying the brain is not part of my professional expertise. Or the other manifestation of so-called deep would be these hidden, covert, computational structures. And in these, as I've written in my first book, I don't believe for theoretical reasons. So if it's not underneath, I do not believe in kind of higher paranormal, parapsychological entities. What one remains with is whatever is on the surface. Like a linguist who is trying to formulate the regularities in language, I'm trying to formulate the regularities in the entire spectrum of human experience.
Why ayahuasca and psychedelic drugs? What brought you into this field of study?
Actually, I came to these completely by chance. I like to travel. I've been all over the world. And in 1991, I was invited to a conference on language and thinking in Brazil, in a Brazilian university, where I delivered the lecture. And because of my fascination with traveling, I've always traveled alone all over the world. So I spent, following the conference, I spent 2 months traveling all over Brazil. And top talking to people, I heard about ayahuasca, which, as I said, is a highly psychoactive a brew that is found in the upper Amazonian region. And I went to the far western end of Brazil, just on the Bolivian border, and I've participated in a ritual of ayahuasca. I should say that I was pretty much naive and ignorant about the use of psychedelic substances beforehand. That ceremony, I should say that they always consume ayahuasca within rituals, never alone. The rituals are very rigid as far as what people are allowed and not allowed to do during the ritual. The rituals are conducted on set dates. One has to observe dietary procedures both before the ceremony, like 3 days, and 3 days after it. So I participated in that ritual, which was impressive for me, but if I remain just with that, I don't think my life, neither personal nor professional, would have changed much. But the next day I was invited to remain in that village community, because they said that in still another day they'll have a ritual conducted only 3 times a year in which the potion is prepared. They prepare it with very, very large quantities, because work is much easier with such quantities. And they invite me to stay, which I did. The potions, the dosages employed in such ritual are much higher than the ordinary ones, which I didn't know. You know, I just followed what people were doing there, and I participated and I helped with the preparation in work itself, which lasted for about 36 hours. And then I had extremely powerful experiences with ayahuasca, a very grand, fantastic, vivid visions. And these experiences indeed have changed me, have changed my worldview. I've kind of unprepared, really. Lo and behold, I was presented with kind of another reality. Sequel to that, I stayed in that village for another week, during which I partook of the beverage for another two times. And then when I got back home, I began reading about it, because I knew practically nothing beforehand. You know, as I was reading, I was more and more fascinated. At the time, like the early 90s, so the books I was reading were from maybe a decade or even 2 decades before then, all the literature, the academic literature, was of two lines. On the one hand, cultural anthropology, because ayahuasca has been serving a key role in the cultures of the indigenous tribal societies of the upper Amazon, their mythologies, their cosmovision, their rituals, their artistic creations, music, dance, pottery. So anthropologists have studied those cultural manifestations quite a bit. On the other hand, there have been studies from the natural sciences, botanists to identify the plants involved, and pharmacologists to identify the molecules that are active in the brew. But I've noted, reading the literature, I've noted two things. First, that the discipline that I think is the most relevant for this, namely, the study of human experience has not studied at that time. It has not been studied at that time. What was studied, as I said, was either the cultural envelope, which is very necessary because it's practically, it's very, very frightening to do this without an aid of a society, of regulations. And on the other hand, as I said, the chemicals and the plants were studied. Again, without the molecules and the plants, no effect will be there. But the interesting thing, people take the plants with the, containing the molecules in order to have a psychological effect. And that psychological effect has practically not been studied. And so I thought also, being a cognitive psychologist myself, that I could apply my academic expertise and bring it together with a study of this brew. Now, the other observation I've had, looking at the literature, the scientific literature, is that almost all the researchers at the time didn't have any first-hand experiences with ayahuasca. At most, maybe one experience that they took the brew in order kind of to establish some right. friendship with the Indians. today, I should say, today, the last kind of 5 years, the situation has changed because there is a new generation of graduate students, especially in Brazil, that do have first-hand experience. But at the time when I began reading the literature, it was totally different, and I thought it's pretty much ridiculous. Imagine it would be like a person studying music without having listened to music ever. Not that that person is not a Mozart or a Beethoven, but that they hardly ever listened to music. So I decided first to have sufficient first-hand experience, and I took a sabbatical, which I passed in Brazil, and I've been returning to Brazil for 17 years, each year at least once, several times twice, not only Brazil, but all this, the Amazonian region in which ayahuasca is used, western Brazil, southern Colombia, Ecuador, and Peru. And I've partaken of ayahuasca many times in different contexts, different indigenous tribes, several syncretic groups. These syncretic groups are in Brazil, and they use the same brew that the Indians use, but the rituals are mostly Catholic, not the Catholicism of the Vatican, but what is called Brazilian popular Catholicism, which mixes Christian traditions with Indian and Afro-Brazilian traditions. It's very vivid in terms of music and dance. There are several such sects. I've participated in rituals of all of them. I've also participated in various kind of independent small groups that do not belong to any institutionalized group. I should say that unlike many of the ayahuasca investigators today, personally, I do not belong to any group. You know, I'm completely ideologically and socially independent. So I'm free and not liable to, subject to any potential pressure, intellectual or practical, in the way I'm conducting my research and in the way I've been interpreted it. And following 70 such experience in different, as I said, in different traditions of use and in different places throughout the Amazon, I began interviewing people, a large number of people, close to 200, And again, my informants came from the different places I visited and from the various contexts of ayahuasca use. This was the first empirical, comprehensive study of ayahuasca with a large group of informants, a heterogeneous informant population. Usually when anthropologists have been studying informants, they all came from the same group or from the same single village. I've been also the first to subject the data of the interviews to numerical analysis, and eventually the data, I've published many, many papers as the research was going on, but the full summary of this investigation is presented in my book that I, whose name I had mentioned before, The Antipodes of the Mind, which really is a very comprehensive, systematic analysis of all the various aspects of the experience that ayahuasca may induce. It's not that every person on each session experiences everything, but when one takes a large number of informants, as I've done, one can get a full picture of the various things that potentially can happen to people with this pool.
Quite fascinating. And
yes,
you named your book after a phrase from Aldous Huxley's Doors of Perception that described his experience with mescaline. Why did you choose Antipodes of the Mind for the title of your book?
Yeah, first I should say that Aldous Huxley, the famous writer, wrote two longish essays that then were published under one cover as not a big book. And the names of these essays were The Doors of Perception and Heaven and Hell, and as they go together, the book is known, has become very, very famous, The Doors of Perception. For Huxley himself, the titles were citations from the famous English writer and mystic William Blake from the 18th century. Huxley was one of the first Europeans to experiment with mescaline on himself in the early 50s, and I like his writing very much. He took actually a very small dosage, and the effect he had, the psychedelic effect he had, was rather weak compared to what we know today. But being a wonderful writer with poetic sensitivity and a high level intellectual, with broad knowledge of various philosophies and wisdom traditions, especially from East Asia, his writing is extremely perceptive, insightful, philosophical, interesting, and I always, even before I had my own experiences, I had kind of intellectual sympathy to Huxley, who is of course not alive anymore. And at the beginning of the second essay, Heaven and Hell, the first essay, Doors of Perception, is primarily an account of the one morning in which he himself experimented with mescaline. And the second essay that complements the first are philosophical and cultural reflections upon the use of psychoactive agents in human history. And he begins that discussion presenting a geographical metaphor in which he says, and he wants to underline the intellectual significance of these substances. And taking this analogy of geography, he says that there used to be a time that human beings were familiar only with the so-called old world, Europe, Western Asia, Northern Africa, and only with the age of the great navigators in the 15th century and on, human beings discovered other continents of Earth, North America, South America, the far reaches of Asia, Southern Africa, Australia, the polar zones. And of course, no geographical charter of planet Earth can be complete if it doesn't include all those so-called new territories. And Huxley argues, and I completely identify with him, that likewise in the mind, if we limit our study of cognition and consciousness only to the ordinary state of normal wakefulness or normal, regular, nocturnal sleep, every night sleep, will be like those geographers that made their analysis of planet Earth only on the basis of that limited area, regions of the old world. So with this, with the use of these substances, the mind encounters we, human beings, and then the psychologists who study them, we encounter the full range of, one can say, the, metaphorically, the geography of the human mind. And personally, I see my task, as I said before, not the study of the brain, but making a systematic charting of the geography of the human mind. I might add that to the exactly same conclusion arrived one of the pioneers of academic psychology and the first great psychology of the United States, William James, at the late 19th century and the first decade of the 20th century. He wrote his famous book, Varieties of Religious Experiences, and there he says, very similar to Aldous Huxley, which came 50 years after him, that if we want to understand what the human mind is, what human consciousness is, we have to look at various states of mind, both ordinary and not ordinary. And interestingly enough, he got to this assessment after having inhaled himself laughter gas, NO2, and James was brave and honest to say explicitly in writing that he got to these ideas following his first experience with a psychoactive substance. Now, just to close this line of thinking, you asked me why I chose Antipodes of the Mind. So when Huxley describes this, presents this geographical analogy, he says, he writes Antipodes of the Mind, so he writes the term Antipodes, which was a term used when people realized that Earth is a sphere and the other side of the sphere would be its antipodes. So just like the great navigators discovered the other side of the Earth, the psychoactive-based research will discover the other side, the antipodes of the mind.
That's quite a fascinating history, and I wasn't familiar with William Blake in that regard. One thing that I wanted...
I might add that Blake I don't have it. I might quote it not exactly every word correct, but the basic gist of it would be correct. Blake, who was a poet, said that if the doors of perception would be cleansed, man would see the world as it is, namely infinite. Yeah, actually, I think that's a precise citation. So that's where Huxley took the term doors of perception, because under the effect of psychoactive substances, people often feel that what they see is more real than real, more true than truth. Perhaps I should add that the term psychedelic, etymologically in Greek, means manifesting the mind. In other words, revealing what otherwise is not seen of the mind. And then, because of the hippie culture in California, in the United States, in the 60s and 70s, this term, which was, you know, old-fashioned Greek, and I think very kind of dignified, lots of not-so-dignified street connotations were associated with it, and in a way one can look at it as a tragedy of that term.
Right. You know, I did want to mention that I think your book, Antipodes of the Mind, actually surpasses Huxley's work and his description of the experience. I think that while yours is more academic-based, you really give both the experienced and unexperienced alike a very firm understanding of what it would be like to go through the experience just by reading your book, and so I applaud you for that. And
yes, thank you very much. I should say that indeed my book is unique in that, in the sense that it's not a personal narrative. It's a systematic academic research where I've investigated both a large number of informants and a fairly large number of my own experiences.
Yes, and you're certainly not one of these academics who has little or no experience with the substances, as you mentioned earlier. And in fact, in your book, you discussed that you had tried ayahuasca 120 times. I think you mentioned 70 times earlier on in the interview. And then I think it was last year you and I were emailing, and you had mentioned that you had now done it more than 160 times. And first,
that's correct. Yeah.
You know, first, I'd like to applaud you for you being so open about your personal experiences, which I think is something rare in academia outside of anthropology typically. But and unlike most other scholars, you didn't just try it once or twice. You actually took the time to understand ayahuasca at the deepest levels of the experience and of consciousness. And so, you know, like I said, I really applaud you for digging into that angle.
Thank you. I should say that taking ayahuasca, increasingly, I got to the feeling, I'm talking now about feeling from the inside, that nobody had told me, that it's like a school, like one, I play the piano. So it's not that one sits by the piano, touches the keys, and that's what it means to play the piano. Ayahuasca is a school. The experience can be very frightening. Often there's quite strong physical, bodily malaise. So one has to step by step proceed forward in this, as I said, schooling. And later I've heard other people say the very same conclusion that came upon them through going further with the brew. So, and the school is long, you know.
Well,
yeah.
So in a way, what you're saying is that somebody who's done it once, while they might have a level four experience from Stan Grof's descriptions, you don't necessarily think that they've learned everything, that there's definitely more to go in and learn.
Yeah, first of all, learning everything, I doubt whether one single individual will ever reach that state, because it's really infinite. But I would also note that even after 10 times, it would be a novice. It won't be first 2 times, but just like, I don't know, listening to Mozart, I like Mozart classical music very much, I've listened to it hundreds of times, you know, and I think it's the same kind of thing.
I couldn't agree with you more, and, you know, sometimes people have told me, well, it doesn't matter if you've done psychedelics once or 100 times or 1,000 times. Once you've had the full-blown experience, you know, that's it. And I disagree. I think it's more like a young person who is, a person who's learning the craftsman skills. And, mm-hmm. you know, a 16-year-old isn't going to most likely build the most phenomenal work, but somebody who's worked their entire life and they're 50 or 60 or 70 years old is going to create great masterpieces. That's not to say that, you know, somebody young can't create a great masterpiece, but, you know, it's typically the older and more experienced the person is, the more skill they're going to have and the deeper understanding of the experience they're going to have as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. You see, what happens under the intoxication, the word intoxication is used in the literature. Perhaps it's not a good word because people have association with alcohol, which is totally, totally different. But I use the word that is in the literature. So what happens under the intoxication is not just an automatic effect of the drink itself, but it's an interaction between the drink, of course, and what are called set and setting. Set is what the individual brings to the situation, their psychological maturity, their biography, their cultural associations, and the setting is a frame, is a context, like the ritual I've been noting, which is extremely crucial in sustaining the experience. Now, a young person can have a very powerful experience, but their tools for making something out of the experience, of digesting it, of the psychological and cultural and intellectual associations, connotations that this young person will bring to the experience will, of course, be much less than those of an older person. Like as I said before about Huxley, the experience really, if one measured strength of experiences with some meters, his experiences, technically speaking, were rather weak. But because he was such a poet and intellectual, he was 50 years of age at the time, he generated this wonderful book out of that experience.
Could you elaborate about the perspective of the book and its methodology?
Yeah. The methodology is phenomenological in the sense that it looks, so to speak, at the surface. It doesn't attempt to look below the surface, trying to find out, I mentioned earlier, neither brain processes nor underlying computation processes that eventually generate the experience. Rather, I look at the experience itself, look at the experience, the data, are the reports of many individuals, including myself. And again, this would be completely analogous to the way a grammarian would work. As I mentioned, my first academic training was in linguistics and psycholinguistics, a grammarian collects a large number of sentences, of utterances in a given language, and then he analyzes regularities in those utterances that were articulated by a large number of speakers of the language. And given that data, the linguist tries to find, to define lawful regularities, which eventually are called the grammar of the language. And I'm doing pretty much the same. I'm taking a large number of reports of the experience. They come from different people. And with all this data in front of me, I try to find regularities. So in a fashion, like, I mean, loosely speaking, one could say that I'm trying to characterize the grammar of the ayahuasca experience.
What are the main findings of your research?
One which is striking is that the contents of the experience... First, let me say the following. The ayahuasca experience is multifaceted. It includes bodily feelings, overall changing of mood, and then you have non-ordinary perceptions with respect to all perceptual modalities, primarily the visual ones. You can have all sorts of visualizations with different degrees of strength and complexity. The weakest and the simplest are arabesques, like repeated geometrical configurations without any cementing content. Then you can have simple semantics, like an isolated figure, say you're seeing a face or a palace or an animal, and then you get stories, scenes, which are more and more complex, both semantically and visually, and eventually you get into entire stories, kind of entire narratives, which would resemble what one sees on the film. And likewise, but less frequently, you can have auditory, non-standard experiences, and also on the other modalities, as well as synesthesia, which is the bringing together of two different perceptual modalities, like seeing music. This is very, very common. And then, in addition to the perceptual effects with all the variety, one can have also action effects. And whereas the perceptual effects are private to the private sphere of the individual, the actional facet are in the public domain. So if people sing, ayahuasca is especially known more than any other psychoactive substance to make people sing. The rituals of ayahuasca are always involve singing, and participants, often possibly without prior familiarity, also begin singing, and the singing can be on the performance level very, very impressive, and those are heard in the real world, by the other people present. People can also play musical instruments, can dance, and again, ayahuasca highly enhances the level of dancing. People may dance for 12 hours in a row under the effect of ayahuasca. I've done this myself, and it's really amazing. Then there are spiritual religious effects, which are very, very common and impress people very deeply and may also alter their worldview. They may become believers, and those beliefs would remain when the intoxication proper has already ended. So I've examined in my book all these different facets and dimensions. I asked, and I developed conceptual categories how to analyze them. Like, for example, the structures of the visualizations I regard as the analog of a linguistic study of morphology, like studying what are words, what are phrases, what are sentences, what is the larger semantics. And these are the structural categories. And then there are content categories. You asked me for impressive results of this research. One prominent result is highly significant interpersonal commonalities in the contents of the visions of different people. I came to that at the very beginning, after I had my first experiences with ayahuasca in Brazil. I came back to the university world, to libraries, and I began reading about ayahuasca. And then I saw, as I said at the time, the only research was done by anthropologists. And I read the reports collected by anthropologists from indigenous people describing their experiences with ayahuasca. And surprisingly enough, I noted that the reports of these indigenous people, in as they appear in the anthropological literature, were very similar. I wouldn't say identical, but very similar. In other words, from the same semantic categories as I myself had in my own visions without knowing anything about it beforehand. Now, the anthropologists, those who were considered to be the deans of ayahuasca research like 30 years ago, attributed the rich visions to the fantasies of the primitive mind of indigenous people. And I thought just the contrary. It's not the mind of the indigenous people of the Amazon, but the minds of human beings in general. It's the Amazon because the plants grow in the Amazon, and the Indians there have perfected ways to make the brew. But what happens as far as the experience is concerned, it's not specific to the Indians at all, and one doesn't have to be an Indian to see those things. You know, that's what happened to me, and that's what I've discovered afterwards with all the people I've interviewed. And I would say that the effects manifest regularities of the human mind as such, not which is, pertains to the psychology of Homo sapiens, not the cultural effects of one in one region of the world or another.
Well, you know, many of the anthropologists will say that that people from the Western culture will have visions about Western concepts and Western religious icons and Jesus and things like that. Well, maybe that's a bad example, but, you know, more traditionally Western visualizations, whereas the indigenous population would have entirely different types of visions. So what you're saying is that's not entirely correct then.
Yeah, correct. It's true what you've just said. One major characteristic of what people see in ayahuasca visions is that the contents of the visions are very distant from the day-to-day experience of people. Yes, at times people may see things that have something to do with their personal and sociological life, but the great majority of things is seen, especially when the visions become more stronger and more powerful, doesn't have anything to do with the actual sociocultural world of the people at hand, but rather it is if a curtain opens and an entirely foreign and fabulous world presents itself to people. And this applies both to indigenous and to European people. Now, it is the case that there are Western people who would say, I've seen, like, Jesus. And I had one informant in Brazil, experienced with ayahuasca, that I've interviewed several times. And especially I was interested in people's either first experience before they knew, you know, when we were still naive and without knowing much about the whole thing, or their more powerful experience. Because the more powerful the experiences, the less is there a kind of biographical, personal fear and concerns, and one gets more that might metaphorically be called the world, the proper world of ayahuasca itself. And this guy described in his one of his most powerful experiences that Jesus appeared before him. And the next time I met him, he volunteered and he said he wanted to make a correction because the fact that he referred to that person as Jesus, he continued and said, was his own culturally determined subjective label. The label as such was not part of the experience, of the vision experience. The experience, what he saw was a man in his mid-30s, clad in white, with his arms open, kind of inviting him with lots of grace. The person's face was full of light and benevolence, and it was a very touching, powerful experience. Now, this informant who was a Brazilian Catholic, he said this himself about himself. It's not that I induced it on the analysis. He said, I called it Jesus because the label Jesus is part of my own religious cultural heritage. But what I saw as such was that person dressed in white that I just described. I myself once had a very similar pattern of experience. I've seen a golden temple, beautiful from an architectural point of view, which is very common with ayahuasca, to see a magnificent, fabulous architecture, be they palaces or temples. And I was thinking to myself that I'm seeing, you know, I'm Jewish, coming from Jerusalem. I was thinking to myself that I'm seeing the Temple of Jerusalem that was destroyed 2,000 years ago.
Right,
and then,
70.
After the experience, I thought to myself, no, it doesn't. What I saw was a marvelous temple made out of gold and architecturally really magnificent. I called it the Temple of Jerusalem because that was in my own repertory of cultural labels. But what I saw was without the label. And when I analyzed the contents of visions reported to me by my informants, I put the labels aside. And what I analyzed is, if one may say, the vision netto. So people think pyramids is extremely common. So most people will say these are the pyramids of ancient Egypt. Many will say these are the pyramids of the Aztecs or the Mayas in pre-Columbian America. But when I analyze them, I would put all of those in the category of pyramids, you know, without the interpretation.
You also collected data in the field in South America for 8 years, and you know, so you've gathered data from all of these different groups and these different types of people. How many people did you say that you collected data from, and what was the core that this data provided for your study?
So, as I've said, I've investigated almost 200 individuals, and the reports they gave me would span about 24 hundred sessions that overall all this group of people have participated in. The range of results is just what I've said, you know, these different aspects of the experience, and for each aspect I try to systematize, to define the subcases of experience pertaining to each kind of experience. Like, again, with the visual dimension, which is the richest and also the most frequently reported, you can have experiences, visual experiences, both with open and with closed eyes. Usually, experiences with closed eyes will be stronger than those with open eyes. There can be some kind of joint effect in open eyes with what one really sees in the actual world and what one brings from one's imagination because of the ayahuasca, the effect of ayahuasca. So, for example, I can see this happened to me, other people sitting in front of the forest and being under the effect of the drink. And one sees, you know, it's like one is dreaming and awake at the same time. So in front of one's eyes, one sees the actual trees of the forest. But
there's
there's
a little bit of static going on there or something.
Both static and dynamic. But on those trees, on those actual trees, one sees birds and butterflies moving and perhaps animals climbing and moving among the trees, and all these animals would not be actual. So the fantasy is imposed on the framework, on the matrix of what one gets by regular perception from the real world. And to your question, the more powerful the vision is, the more dynamic, kind of, it's like a film, you know, that proceeds, the narrative proceeds. Then there can be even more powerful effects. So far, what one sees is like in the movie house. One sits, and in front of one eyes there's a screen, and on the screen there are visualizations with a story. But here with ayahuasca, you can have something that doesn't happen with the movies. One can be invited to step into the scene. This can be frightening because the more a person gets into the scene, the more they become distant from the security of actual, you know, the actual real situation. So I've analyzed that, and here too, one can discern stages. Like first one might enter the scene of the vision and stand, keep to the corner, just observing, but standing still. Then one might begin walking around on stage, within the world of the scene. Walking around, some creatures may come forward and the person may be invited to interact with them. I should emphasize that what one sees in the scene does not depend on the person, on the drinker at all. It is not at all that one can decide, today I want to see a palace. No. However, whether one advances within the scene and how much one allows themselves to get into the scenario of the narrative, this depends on the person themselves. I know for myself that, like, I was standing in front of a gate. So I was invited to step through the gate and enter kind of a golden palace. So the decision, nobody forced me. The decision to enter was my own. You know, one brings one's personality to this fantasy world. And one of the most experienced people I've ever interviewed was a Peruvian ayahuasca. Ayahuasca is a shaman using ayahuasca. And the most powerful experience he said he had after 40 years of at least weekly practice with his brew, he said that he entered a golden palace, and there was at the end of the chamber, there was an open door, so he stepped through the door, and he got into another golden chamber. And then there was another door, and like this, one after the other, 10 times, and stepping in the last, the 10th chamber, there was a group of elders sitting there, and they all clapped their hands and lauded him. You've made it, you know, you've come to the Holy of Holies. And he said, with all the experience he had had, he wept. He was wept out of happiness, and he felt that he has made it. And that's, he recounted to me as the most powerful experience he's ever had. Now, a person kind of on the side would say, what's the big deal? You know, this was all fantasy, nothing great about it. So he saw 10 chambers. But it isn't like that, because stepping from one chamber to another is an accomplishment of the person himself, even though the chambers themselves are the province of fantasy. But the stepping further depends on the courage of the person, of the individual drinker, and on his willingness to let go and get along with the lines of the fantasy. And that's not trivial at all. And that's, by the way, earlier we spoke of the effect of experience, so that's a major effect of experience, to learn to go on, to have, to let the fear aside and get more into and into the experience, the world of the experience.
Well, it seems to me that anthropologists seem to have come to a premature decision. I think it seems of utmost importance to do follow-ups with people as they progress. And you know, I remember in your book you mentioned when somebody typically reaches around 90 experiences with ayahuasca, it's like they graduate to a whole new level in the experience. So, you know,
I don't know if it's not always the same number.
Right.
I would say there are, like in school, like elementary school, high school, undergraduate, graduate, for me it was, I think, first time after 30 experiences, I felt I've stepped up, like I moved from the elementary school to middle school. And that experience is shared by other people. The number of sessions until one feels one has moved to a new level, that number differs for different people. But what is common that with extended experience, one feels that one has upgraded, yeah.
Yeah, I guess what I was getting at, though, is that it's unfortunate, and I'm not trying to bash on anthropologists because a lot of anthropologists listen to the show, but you know, that seems an important thing to do, is to follow up and to make sure that we're not reaching preconceived conclusions about what people are seeing in these visions and their understanding of them as they progress in their own personal unfoldment.
Yeah, and also I want to say that it's not kind of just simply stated that anthropologists are wrong. The goals of the aims of anthropology as a scientific endeavor are very different from those of a psychologist. A psychologist is interested to learn about the mental life of the individual and of human cognition consciousness. The scientific aims of anthropologists are different. They are to study societies and cultures and how cultures develop art, rituals, mythologies, religious practices, and the like. So the aims are very different. Eventually, the results of anthropology and the results of psychology can be brought together. Like I myself, as I was traveling, I've collected, not as a scientist, but as a person, talked to people, different myths about the origin of ayahuasca from different people. And that could be data for anthropologists, but also the myths reflect some psychological sentiments that people have. Also, I think a very, very central significance that the study, the psychological study of ayahuasca has from a scientific point of view is what I said earlier on in conjunction with both Aldous Huxley and William James, that when I study the non-ordinary experiences of human consciousness, I can draw more general conclusions about what I call the system, the entire system of human consciousness. I'll give you a simple analogy. If I'm wearing spectacles on my eyes all the time, other than being asleep or in the bathroom. So and the eyeglasses are on my nose. So since I was 11, I'm not aware of them at all. But the eyeglasses have some value. The lens has a number, a diopter. The lens may have a certain color. Mine are transparent. And I'm not aware of neither the size of the lens nor the color. However, if I were to, like when you go to an eye exam, if the number of the lens would be changed, or the coloring of the lens would change, then all of a sudden the person comes to realize that the lens has a number, that the lens has color. So it's only, I call these parameters, the size of the lens and its color. But one appreciates the existence of the parameter only when the value of upon this parameter changes. And I think the same with human psychology and consciousness. Normally, like before I said it with ayahuasca, also with other psychological, psychoactive substances, as described by Huxley himself, with respect to mescaline, people feel that what they see is more real than real. Now, what does it mean, more real than real? A normal human being opens their eyes, sees the world. The world is real. But what is more real than real? Reality, the experience of reality is, in my terminology, is a parameter that we normally take as having only one single value. Let's call this value one. But with ayahuasca or mescaline, one feels the reality is more than one. Excuse me, more real than real, so let's give it the value more than one. Sometimes it's the opposite. Let's say you haven't had sleep for a long time, like you're obliged to remain awake, and now it's 3-4 in the morning, you haven't slept almost a day, and you become kind of fuzzy. What you see is blurred. You are not exactly sure whether it's real or half awake. So I would say the experience of reality, not reality proper, but the experience of reality, this parameter would get a value less than one. So with the broadening of the values of the parameters, that's how I, as a theoretician in psychology, I broaden the scope of both the parameters of cognition and the values of those parameters. And here again, we come to what you've asked me at the beginning of the interview. The title of my book, The Antipodes of the Mind, is revealing all those parameters and values of the human mind that normal, ordinary state of consciousness would not be manifest.
You bring science and the metaphysical toe-to-toe in the dance. What was the ending conclusion of your ayahuasca study?
Yeah.
And were you able to prove that it was just a chemical response in the brain, or do you think that this ayahuasca experience might actually be something real?
You are presenting here as if there are just two alternatives, and I think there are more than two. First, I want to say, you said chemistry and the brain. Undoubtedly, there's no question about it, those experiences are triggered by the consumption of substances, including psychoactive molecules that eventually affect neurotransmitters in the brain. As a consequence of this heightened brain activity on the neuropharmacological level, we have those experiences. However, talking like now the two of us are conversing, there's also brain activity and neurotransmitters going this and this direction, and different regions of the brain are activated. And without that activation, we wouldn't have the conversation we are having. However,
right.
To understand our conversation, it wouldn't give you anything, give us anything, looking inside the brain and see the neurotransmitters. In order to understand our conversation, one has first and foremost to know the English language, then to know that I am a university person who has studied something, that you are a person directing a project about this topic. No one would open your brain and mine in order to understand what's the conversation. Without the brain, we wouldn't have the conversation. But to understand the conversation, that's not the way to go about it. Like I said, I think before, that I play the piano. Now, if I want to understand what's the difference between a Mozart piano sonata and Beethoven piano sonata, I wouldn't open this piece of furniture, which is called the piano, and look at the metal strings inside that wooden box. Or without those metal strings, no sound would be heard. But if I want to understand what constitutes the beauty of a Mozart sonata, the level of analysis would be completely different. So the same is my approach to ayahuasca. I do not deny that the brain is involved here, but studying the brain is not something that I look at. And I think, first, it's not my level of expertise, domain of expertise, and I also think that's not the level we'll gain much. We learn, of course, about the brain, which is a challenge, but we won't get much insight about the ayahuasca experience itself. Now, when we look at the experience, there can be three theoretical directions that are possible. One is to say that those experiences, as you suggested, the metaphysical, come from elsewhere, from a superior world above us, of a world of entities that are not human, perhaps divine entities. All the indigenous people who have been using ayahuasca for ages believe this. The visions one sees are so extraordinary, so fabulous, so vividly real, experienced as vividly real, so distant to anything that those people, be they indigenous or Western, have experienced in their actual lives, that people say, what can this be? It must be coming from a higher, totally other than me regions. And most people, Brazilians, who are they are not indigenous people, they are like Western people, you know, residents of Rio de Janeiro or Sao Paulo, who have had these powerful experiences, believe the same, that these experiences come from a different metaphysical realms. I personally, I'm both a psychologist and a trained philosopher, I try to not to jump into radical ontological metaphysical conclusions. The other alternative, I've said that there might be three. So the first is the metaphysical, which is for me, maybe I'm wrong, but for me as an academic Western person, and I might add also as a very careful kind of individual, so I'm not going towards this direction, the ontological. The other direction is to say that ayahuasca reveals the inner hidden depth of the human psyche, like what one has in psychoanalysis. But I have examined, I've collected a corpus of dreams, like to compare it with the corpus that I've collected of ayahuasca visions. And the kind of things experienced in dreams and in ayahuasca visions are very, very different. In dreams, usually one sees things having to do with one's individual conflict. One sees, especially when one is younger, one's parents, people close to one. One sees a kind of a fragment of often trivial things that have happened to one in the last, in the, during the 48 hours preceding the dream, a sexual conflict, of course. None of those things are typical of ayahuasca visions, where you see people see mythological beings, extraordinary palaces, as I've said, strange creatures. One feels that one encounters the divine. None of those last items have I ever experienced in the dozens of years that I've been sleeping. I've never had an encounter with the divine when I sleep, you know. So my conclusion is that this account, which is in the lines, in the same conceptual machinery of psychoanalysis, wouldn't suit ayahuasca visions either. So if it's not the discovery of reality above, nor of convert psychological reality below, the conclusion I've been drawn to is to say that during the intoxication, people get kind of a short, maybe 6 hour period of grace in which ordinary people are invested with a wonderful power of creativity. Because what a major facet of what one sees in ayahuasca visions has to do with culture and art. As I mentioned before, temples, palaces, fabulous architecture, magnificent works of art, dance, music. So I would say that rather than being retrieved or discovered, what one sees in ayahuasca visions is created on the spot. Now, at the beginning, this may sound kind of far-fetched, but if we look at human cultures, even very small tribal cultures, there's never been throughout history a human culture without artistic creations, without even illiterate societies, without song, without dance, without stories. Not that every member of the society is an artist, but in each society there are artists. So I would say that with ayahuasca, each person is given for a short period of time kind of the gift, the privilege, the invitation to be kind of an artist. It doesn't happen to all people who drink ayahuasca, but it happens to most of them. And from this, I would also conclude that the artistic dimension, like what I said before about the parameters of the eyeglasses, the artistic as well as the religious experience are ingrained parameters of the human psyche. When one reads normal texts in cognitive psychology, There is nothing neither about aesthetics nor about religious experience. However, as with ayahuasca, things, everybody, really, universally, people say that when they look at things, be it with open or closed eyes, things look much more beautiful, much more aesthetic than ordinarily they are. Or that they have religious and spiritual experiences. So I would infer from that the aesthetic and the religious, spiritual, are inbuilt parameters of the human psyche that under ordinary circumstances might, for most people, be kind of not coming to the fore, you know, not expressing themselves. And what the psychedelic experience, as its name indicates, psychedelic as I said, is manifesting the psyche. The experience allows the psyche to manifest its other parameters, in this case here, the aesthetic and the religious.
How has ayahuasca affected your own spirituality?
I would say that it has introduced spirituality to me as a person. I've partaken of ayahuasca the first time when I was 41 years old, and I should say, which is usually, for the same biological generation as mine, in the U.S., the generation of the late 60s, early 70s, people have had those experiences when they were half the age. But in Israel, there was a six-day war. I was in the army those years. So I did not have those experiences when I was younger. But if you look at traditional Jewish texts, specifically the Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, it says precisely that the proper age to enter into the domain, to the mystical domain of Kabbalah, would be when a person is 40 years of age and when they have a profession and family. In other words, when the person is not a child anymore and they are established, they are solid, both as individuals and within society. So I'm glad it was that age when I had my first experiences. Now, of course, being a philosopher and being, a person involved in culture, I knew about spirituality beforehand. But to say the truth, I haven't experienced that kind of experiences as an individual. I've read about them, but I knew about them. I heard from other people. But I never had a spiritual personal experience. And if you ask me what was the main effect ayahuasca and the involvement with it on me as a person, not as a professor of university that I've written a book, I've done all the statistics, but on me as an individual, so my answer is very, very clear, that it has opened the dimension of the sacred to me, that is, introduced me to this realm of the holy, which has remained with me ever since, even without drinking ayahuasca. It's like a person, if I may use the example, having the first time of their lives, youngster, having romantic affairs, both with the body and with the heart. So, and they think, I remember the first time it happened to me, think, really, it's such a thing. It's amazing. It's like a totally new dimension, the erotic, the romantic. Now, I've read love poems and romantic stories before, but when I experienced it, it was like the first time in history, kind of. And I would say that the same kind of firstness or freshness happened to me when I was much older with ayahuasca, with regards to the dimension, as I said, of the sacred, of the holy.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the Kabbalah, because the Book of Zohar, I believe, mentions fungus. And I remember in your 2008 article that you released last January in Time and Mind, you mentioned Rabbi Ben Asher who mentioned that manna possesses such qualities as psychedelic qualities as drugs as well.
Yeah.
And so that's just a very interesting tie-in that you made there.
Let me just comment on what you said. I do not recall that the Zohar mentions fungi, but the Zohar mentions, which was one of the most major mystical Jewish texts, it mentions visions, and the visions with fabulous architecture, gold, precious stones, reminds one of ayahuasca visions. I myself, in my article that you have mentioned, I've referred to plants that grow in the Israel desert called the Negev, southern Israel, and the adjacent Sinai desert peninsula. And there they grow two plants which are very different from the Amazonian plants of ayahuasca, but each of those plants contains the same molecules, chemical molecules, that the Amazonian plants contain, the Amazonian plants of which ayahuasca is made. And I suggested, as I call my paper a speculative hypothesis, that the origins of the Israelite religion 3,000 years ago had to do with the consumption of such plants. Such a hypothesis, where I should say, were proposed before me with respect to other ancient cultures. Very ancient India, the pre-Columbian religions of Central and South America. So the idea is that people have open the door to the divine realm with the use of psychoactive plants and radical changes of state of consciousness is not an idea that I personally have originated. What I've done is to apply this to the specific cultural context of Judaism.
Right. I don't know if this translation is correct, but what I have very quickly here is from the Book of Zohar, Jacob's Journey, and it continues down about 8 or 10 paragraphs down. The secret of secrets, out of the scorching noon of Isaac, out of the dregs of wine, a fungus emerged, a cluster, male and female together, red as a rose, expanding in many directions and paths. And that description there just reminds me a lot of the descriptions of the Amanita muscaria mushroom that John Allegro argued about back in 1970 regarding Judeo-Christianity. And so, like I said, though, I haven't verified that translation.
No, I would like, do you remember which chapter of the Zohar this is found in?
It's in, let's see, it says the creation of Elohim. And then, let me see here. Then under that, it's Jacob's Journey.
Okay, thank you very much. I don't recall it. I'm not a Zohar expert, although I've read the book. I'll check with experts both concerning the place and the translation. You know, Amanita muscaria does not grow in Israel, in the Holy Land. And also, there have been all sorts of scientific criticisms of Allegro's book,
well,
on the details. But I might add on my own personal level that one of the first times I've drank ayahuasca with Indians in the Amazon was that I had experience of a ladder of angels going up and down that ladder, and then I thought how similar it is to the Jacob's experience in the Book of Genesis. But
right.
I'll check with Zohar experts, and I know some well-known people here in Jerusalem.
I should mention that the Cedars of Lebanon no longer really exist, and I think that would have been a prime location. And Robert Graves reported in, I believe, 1956 or 1957 in one of his books on seeing Amanita muscaria in the region. Also, and many of the ancient stories discuss these herbs and substances being heavily traded, but you mentioned the academic attacks on Allegro's work. Actually, my last book, The Holy Mushroom, I analyzed each and every one of those attacks, and I spent more than 4 years working with John Allegro's daughter refuting all of those, so that might be of interest to you.
Yeah, very much. I haven't seen your book, but I'd be extremely interested to read it. Yeah.
Let me ask you, intellectually, what are the main implications of your research and book, and what would you like people to remember?
A couple of things. First, that like with the metaphor of geography and geographical discovery that Huxley uses, and from which the title of my book comes, that we see, I've learned, and I've passed it to my students, that the realms of human consciousness are broader than psychologists usually assume when they study only normal wakefulness and normal nightly sleep and dreams. Then the dimensions by which we may by which we academic psychologists may study human consciousness are also much broader, richer, and complex when we include the psychedelic experience within the scopus of our research, and we see that much more is going on. Eventually, I would say that human consciousness is much more mysterious, much more wondrous than regularly academic cognitive psychologists assume. Then, for me as an academic, it's most important, maybe it's less so for the layperson, all the technical distinctions that I've introduced, like when I just alluded to them here in this conversation in passing, but the different, like the syntax, not the contents, but the semantics, but the syntax of ayahuasca visions, all this step by step, like the moving from the level of what I said, analogously to a word, to a phrase, what are the different phrases, the structure of sentences, all on the visual level. So I've developed an entirely novel conceptual framework that can be readily applied to the study of other substances like mescaline, mushrooms, dreams, fantasies in the mystical literature. Nobody has done it, but it's kind of the conceptual framework which I have developed now is already to be applied to other domains of non-ordinary either experiences or texts. And then what I've said with regard to me as a person, I said earlier, that has changed my own worldview, and I know of many, many other individuals, both with higher level education, without higher level education, that the very same has happened to them, that in the dimension, what I said earlier, the dimension of the sacred open to them.
Thank you so much for a very, excuse me, a very interesting interview. And I wanted to ask you if you could say something about your other lines of research. And I know you mentioned a book earlier that you were working on, if you could mention the name of that again. And also I wanted to ask if you have any relevant material on the web that you could refer people to.
Yeah. As I said, my academic education was in linguistics, Chomsky linguistics, the psychology of language when it was still in its early years, philosophy of language, and I've worked a lot in these domains, primarily the dimension of semantics, how one analyzes the meaning of sentences and also larger linguistic units like stories. And studying these, I've come to appreciate how crucial the importance of context is. That the same, I was not the first to come to this conclusion, but at the same time, these investigators realized that the same verbal utterance can gain a totally different meaning and significance depending on what is called the pragmatic factors, depending on the context where and when the phrase is articulated and by whom it is made. I'll give you an example which is not mine. If the Queen of England comes to a wharf and takes a bottle of champagne in her hands and throws it and it smashes against the wall of a ship, at the same time the Queen says, "Hereby I name this ship Queen Mary," then everybody applauds, and from that moment the name of the boat is indeed Queen Mary. But if another English woman would come to the same boat and pick up a bottle of champagne and throw it in the boat, the boat will not be called by that name, and even people kind of look at the woman and say, what she's doing is kind of ridiculous. Yeah. So the and it's not that the knowledge of the English language of Queen Elizabeth is better, higher than that of the woman. They are both native speakers of English. So it's just the pragmatics, the context in which the utterance is articulated. So then I applied this fundamental observation of the context dependencies of linguistic utterances, which again was not mine originally, but I further investigated psychologically, and I investigated other, what I called earlier when I spoke of the spectacles and the lens, parameters of human cognition that usually are taken as outside of what was called pure cognition, like our body, not the physiological body, the brain, but our what the French philosopher Merleau-Ponty called phenomenal body, the body we experience, our hands with which we make gestures, our face with which we kind of make expressions, our torso that moves. And you look at people, at least if you look at me now as I'm talking on the phone and I don't see you, but my hands are moving. Because movement of hand is part and parcel of human language.
Right.
I would say language is articulated not only by mouth, but through the body that is in the real world. I write a lot, but I cannot, so people would say, what is writing? Is the conversion of ideas in the mind to words which are written or printed. But again, I've said I write a lot, but I cannot write without a keyboard. In order that kind of my thinking will work, to activate my mind and my linguistic expression, my fingers have to move. So one may say that thinking is done with the aid of the hands. Or the French famous writer Marcel Proust has this famous opening episode of his, three thousand page epos, when he found himself as a child biting the little cookie dropped in tea, and the memories, this he does as an adult, and with the taste and the texture of the cookie, the entire memories of his breakfast, childhood breakfast, come to mind with a touch of the taste. So it's not that he asked himself to remember, and then the memory came up. It was not a computational retrieval process, but rather an unasked for immediate non-mediated bodily, namely taste in this case, experience. So all these and much more indicate that the human thinking system is not like a computer. A computer doesn't have sense of taste. The computer doesn't have hands. The computer is very sophisticated, but it consists only of internal symbols and coupled with computational operations that manipulate these symbols. And almost all of contemporary academic psychology takes this model of the computer and it says that's how human beings operate from a cognitive point of view. And I said, not at all, not at all. And you see, this gives us not only different models for human cognition, not only different scientific understanding, but also different perspective of what is a human being. Like for Freud, human being was a system which is very dark, and the lots of it what's going on is frightening, is dirty, it has to be pushed down to the basement so it won't be seen. That's one view of what a human being is. Another, in contemporary cognitive psychology, is a human being is a sophisticated computer. And the vision I have is also in conjunction with my ayahuasca research that the human being is an inventor of language, of metaphor. I've worked a lot on metaphor. I won't get into this here. And also the inventor of art and culture. And I think this is a much more gay and happy and also enriching view of what a human being is.
And
the book I'm writing now, I'm not sure about the final title, but I do know that it will be a short title, one of the words being consciousness, and it's a book which has one foot in cognitive psychology, another foot in philosophy, and it's presented a new, really utterly novel a theory of how to analyze the different aspects of human consciousness.
And do you have any relevant material on the internet?
I have a website, but which is I prepared it years ago, which is not very sophisticated. One can type my name again, Shannon with one N, and get to this. Last week I sat with a person and we said we'll work on broadening that website. And the other way is to type the names of my two books that have been published, and there are lots of references to them on the web, especially if one enters Amazon.com in the entries. For the Antipodes of the Mind, the first book was published before Amazon.com came to existence. But for the book on ayahuasca, Antipodes of the Mind, there's lots of material there. There are more than a dozen reviews of the book. Some are by people that are world famous. And yeah, both describe and evaluate the book, yeah.
In fact, one of those reviews up there I wrote, so I'm not...
I didn't have it in mind now. Thank you very much, both for writing it and for telling me now. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And I have to say that I think that your book is one of the greatest contributions to the entire field of psychedelic studies, so... Thank you for writing that, and it's amazing that you got Oxford University Press to publish that as well.
Yeah, I should say it was the first time they, you know, it's such a conservative publisher, they send it to three reviewers, and it's the first time they published a book on such a domain, such a topic, they send it to three reviewers, all of them recommended publication, so they say we just might as well send to a fourth, and it was accepted with some minor brushing of the English, which is not my native language, but yeah, it's a large book, you know, small print, 500 pages, but yeah, and I'm very glad. I wanted to have an academic book. That was my kind of my goal for myself. It would have been much, by far easier to write a personality, maybe asking a dozen people, other people, I wouldn't mention names, have done the same. I could write such a book in 2 weeks. And on this book, I've collected and analyzed the data for 5 years. I've done the writing itself for another 2 years. It was lots of work, and it's less of a bestseller than, you know, kind of a personal narrative, but that's what I wanted to do, really to have an academic work that I hope will be more long-lasting than a bestseller in this domain.
I think you certainly achieved that. And we've been listening to Professor Benny Shannon from Hebrew University of Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Israel. Benny, thank you so much for the wonderful interview and your time with me here today. And I look forward to your future endeavors. And maybe we can get together sometime and share ideas.
Thank you very much for this interview as well. I really enjoyed it very, very much, and I'm looking forward, to see you once face to face.
All right, Benny. Take care and have a great
Yeah,
day.